The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, before we go to our guest today, let's just give our listener a little bit of a background. Bert Doman.
Kevin, Bert Doman and my dad are good friends and have known each other for decades. We've
right.
been in the financial business for four decades ourselves, and Doman goes back to the 60s and 70s as well. We have read his reports, the Wellington Letter, for years, and have gleaned a lot of things in terms of technical analysis from his reports. I do encourage our listeners to look at the Wellington Letter at their first opportunity.
Well, and one of the areas that your dad and Bert Doman are very similar is they just put what they think in writing. They put it out there. They say, this is what I think is going to happen. You know, and they live with the results. But what's interesting, both with Don McIlvaney, who for four decades has been writing a newsletter, and Bert Doman, who's been writing just about as long, you can go back and check their work. In fact, there are ways to do that. They currently publish these things.
And I think, Kevin, looking at his Prelude to Meltdown, a book that he wrote in 2007, and most recently, Financial Apocalypse, it's an interesting retrospective. What has happened and led us to this point? And in the sense that he has in his most recent book is that we actually have the second and bigger shoe yet to drop, and it is imminent. So we will discuss some of those things with Bert today. It's with great fondness that we have these conversations, because usually in between the times that we have him on the program, I'll get to share a great meal with him, whether it's in the Bahamas or California or Las Vegas or someplace on the planet. Our families get to interact and compare notes, both personally and professionally, and that's a great joy.
Yeah, David, I've been fortunate enough to actually be part of a couple of those meals, and they're always enjoyable because we get to hear about the grand scheme of world economics and politics, and then it comes right back down to very personal issues.
Well, without further ado, you know, we have the current Treasury and Fed regimes having adopted a decidedly Keynesian view of the crisis and its solution. They've attempted to prop up aggregate demand through deficit spending, through cheap capital, through ample liquidity, you know, between $1 and $1.65 trillion are the new debts, which are now being added to old each year. That's the deficit spending. And we're treating issues today as if there's not a structural part to them at all. That's what they seem to be missing, is that what we have in play are major structural issues. Additional debts are being used to solve a debt problem, which is kind of a gross irony, and Fed measures have not yet been exhausted. And in that regard, we look at the creativity which will be used, the creativity which will be exemplified in the months and years ahead, as we have new degrees of market pressure, and we look at the Fed and Treasury scramble to try to keep things together. What might we expect? That's the question we want to discuss with Bert Doman today. What might we expect from the Fed and Treasury as the fight both to preserve the dollar system along with the modern system of Ponzi finance, that fight begins to intensify? What does it look like when the gloves come off? Do we see market manipulations? Do we see a change in trading rules? Do we see mandated investment choices? Something like we're watching right now in real time in Europe, like the forced rollovers being agreed to in Greece as we speak. There's not a default, but there's also not a return of capital either. You get to participate whether you wanted to or not. Bert, thanks for joining us. We'd love to get the big picture and then hone in on some of the specific asset classes which you follow so studiously.
But it's nice to be with you, David. And, you know, what you just outlined is absolutely terrific, because those are really the very important questions that the world is facing now. And it's interesting, when you listen to most economists and most analysts, you don't hear these topics being discussed in that way. But this is really the important way to look at it. It is Ponzi finance, as you called it.
Well, the battle in Europe, you know, this is what is in play at the moment. We have credit default swaps, which are something of a tidal wave. Will they prevent that tidal wave, and at what cost? Will that cost even be political stability? We've had upset elections in Germany, Italy, Spain, and it's now over the weekend Portugal, where the socialists apparently didn't look out for the people's interest enough. And there is a battle in terms of the credit default swap market. That is a symptom of what's happening in the larger credit markets themselves, credit default swaps being an insurance against default. Maybe you want to shed some light on what is happening in the credit markets. Looking back at 2006 and 7, you were predicting an imminent demise in the credit markets and in the equity markets. You've written again most recently in your book, Financial Apocalypse, Predicting the Unpredictable, that a lot of these things do boil back to major credit issues, whether you're talking about the big picture credit issues of 30, 40 years of rampant credit, or the more intense and, frankly, almost on steroids, credit boom of 2003 to 2007. We haven't really seen a complete credit unwind. We saw something of that in 2008, but is that just a foreshadowing?
First, let me address what you said about credit default swap. This is a very important point, and I think you're probably the only person I have heard so far even mentioning that topic in connection with Europe. The credit default swaps, just for your listeners, they're the kind of insurance instruments against default of the debt instruments. You know, in this case, in Europe, would be sovereign debt of Greece, Portugal, etc. And you can buy these, and they go up in value when the credit instruments that underlie them become more risky. Now what we have in the case of Greece, because of the basically rescheduling of debt and so on, some of these credit default swaps, if not all of them, have clauses in there, reset clauses, that basically, you know, I haven't read all of these, they're complicated instruments and so on, but it's very likely that these credit default swaps are going to come into question of people that think that, well, the debt was downgraded of Greece, therefore I made a lot of money on my CDSs, but they may not be able to collect because of some of the clauses, or it may be deemed to be a total default for the purpose of these CDSs. This is going to be a big legal battle in the courts, in my opinion, and it's going to be in the courts for some time. So what in the end, what it does, it really destroys the confidence that people have in the financial system. How much confidence can you have when suddenly things that you thought had value don't have any value? It's very similar to when Chrysler was taken over by the government. The lenders to Chrysler thought that they had priority one position amongst the creditors. No, and they were put way down the list by Washington, even below the demands of the union. So we're seeing really a destruction of confidence in the financial system. And you can tell already the retail customer, the retail investor is gone. When you take a look at the charts of mutual fund inflows, that hit the peak in the year 2000. Since 2000, less and less money has been going into mutual funds. So that was a real long-term top in the markets. The actual retail investor is fleeing the markets. He has no more confidence in the market. And I think that is very, very important. So what we've got now is a situation where 70 to 80% of the daily volume in the U.S. stock market is just these high-frequency trading programs. And their average stay in their positions is measured in seconds or minutes, not in days or weeks or years. In fact, they put in bids and asks at lightning speed, 10,000, 20,000 prices in a second's time, and they're canceled in less than a second. In fact, the SEC is considering one rule, which means that these high-frequency operations would have to leave their bid or their ask in the market for a minimum of 1 second. Can you believe that?
Well, you know, the high-frequency trading, black box trading, whatever you'd like to call it, it's interesting that it really has covered over the fact that the New York Stock Exchange, the Amex, NASDAQ, has become a ghost town. As you say, there are no retail investors to speak of. They've been replaced by computer trading models. You know, you've mentioned on a couple of occasions, and reiterate this in your book, Financial Apocalypse, that for long-term investing, you've said that you can't return to sort of a broad value investing thesis where a buy-and-hold strategy works until about 2017. I'd like to discuss the course we're likely to be on between now and then. Coming back to that, 2017, what has to take place to sort of clean up this town?
Yeah, in my book, Prelude to Meltdown, which was written in late 2007, I said, you know, we're going to go into something similar to 1929 or maybe worse. And the first chance of a sustainable bottom, the first chance is 2017, and that's just going by cycles. After a major credit bubble bursts, it usually takes 17 years to get the system back to basics. But I think when you consider what's happening right now in Washington, I think the actual bottom will take much longer to form. Everything that can be done wrong is being done in Washington, and I don't see any chance of that major trend to reverse to the more positive side.
You know, I mentioned earlier that we could see the gloves come off with D.C. treating New York as sort of the scapegoat for many of the misdirected policies that they actually have put in play. And we did see a change of rules, as you mentioned, right in the middle of the Chrysler unwind, wherein creditors got the short end of the stick. I'm reminded of what governments can do when put under extreme duress. It's not something we've seen since maybe the 90s with any great frequency, but capital controls. You know, they're used to prevent hot money from entering and abruptly leaving a market, or to prevent flight capital in the event of a banking or currency crisis. Sage advice, if you will. What are the probabilities, and are there other more reasonable means of the government sort of taking the gloves off, so to say?
Yeah. The thing right now, people have to really consider that the impossible is possible. I was just at a hedge fund conference a few weeks ago. There were 1,700 hedge fund guys there. And on a panel was Senator Chris Dodd. And he said that in 2008, during the crisis, that the country was within 10 minutes of the government shutting down the banking system, within 10 minutes. And I thought that was an incredible statement. So here, these idiots that caused the crisis were ready to shut down and create a real global crisis by shutting down the banking system. What use would that have been? I mean, they would have really compounded their original stupidity by not having recognized what I and other people did recognize already 1 year ahead of time, namely that we're heading into a major financial crisis. So with that kind of thinking, where they would just shut down the entire banking system, good banks and bad banks alike, means that there's absolutely no limit to what they will do. And that is what I warn people in the futures markets about. They can close down the futures markets in an instant, and they will. And my prediction is that sometime over the next 5 years, they will close down the futures market. And especially people that are invested in gold futures and silver futures and metals futures, they should be aware of this. This happened one other time, but it wasn't done by the government. It was done by the exchange itself. You remember Bunker Hunt? His brother, mm-hmm. They tried to corner the silver market in 1980, and then the exchange just said, okay, effective tomorrow morning, no new buying will be allowed. Only selling will be allowed. Wow. If anybody would have said that they would do that 1 week ahead of that, they would have probably put him away because he was insane. But the exchange did it, and the exchange got away with it. And, of course, that's when silver really plunged. So anything is possible right now. There's absolutely nothing in Washington that is no longer possible. And as investors, I think we have to take that into consideration.
It's interesting that such a small amount of actual silver is traded through Chicago, roughly 5% of the silver market, and yet a change in rules there has major ripple effects. We saw the margin increases 5 times sequentially just a month or so ago and caused a precipitous fall. Arguably, silver was well ahead of itself at nearly $50 an ounce. But, you know, here you have really a two-bit player, a minority player, if you will, controlling 5% of the market, and yet they do have a very loud voice. It was interesting. We spoke with some folks that work directly with the exchange, and the deliveries of physical metals are coming from CTAs and hedge funds in numbers for 2010 and early 2011 that have not been seen ever. You know, CTAs and hedge funds typically like the liquidity of futures contracts, and I think they're realizing what you just said, Bert, which is you don't want to play a game where the rules can be changed right in the middle of play. So, yeah, I think they're wising up to the fact that somewhere between DC and NYMEX, COMEX, there's a set of rules that they're not privy to, and maybe they should just play in the physical market.
I think the precious metal story is far from being over, and you got to have physical, and you got to have it in a safe place. And that is the only good long-term investment for the average person that I would consider, really.
Yeah.
I cannot think of anything else. And, you know, there was a point about Japan or about low interest rates and then, you know, high inflation, loss of confidence in the currency. Take a look at Japan. 20 years, they've been grinding down. And the economy goes from maybe 2% growth to 2% negative, 2% growth again, just bouncing around the zero level. And they've got the highest debt level in the world. I think it's about twice as bad as the United States. Interest rates are very, very low. Very low. They're near zero, okay? Because the government is keeping them there. So you have a situation there where the government has been pumping so much artificial money into the system to pay the bills, and yet the interest rates are staying low. Now, granted, they financed a lot of their debt with internal savings, which we don't have, okay? So eventually, the people who are financing our debt, namely foreigners, are going to get tired of this, and they're probably going to withdraw some of their financing, and that will make our interest rates rise. There's so many complications in this thing. I don't know if even a supercomputer can figure it out.
No, about interest rate suppression, it's something that can be done, as you point out, with Japan for many, many years, even multiple decades. Is the circumstance different for us? Certainly it's changing in Japan because the demographic is changing. They're running out of a saving class as people are dying off. Yeah. So the demographic end game is on the horizon for them, and being able to finance it internally, that's a game over. For us, it is on the kindness of strangers, 47% held in foreign hands, and with an appetite that's waning. You know, recent tick flows were showing 5 months in a row of declining interest by foreign central banks and treasuries. At this point, not to a very large degree. I mean, you're talking $40 billion, no big shakes in a multi-trillion dollar market.
But the Federal Reserve will buy whatever is not bought by anyone else. So is there a limit to how much it can buy? What if they have to buy 100% of what the Treasury offers? Will that affect our interest rate?
You just have to quit publishing the balance sheet numbers at the Fed.
Yeah, but people don't seem to care. I mean, they've got a balance sheet now of, what, $3 trillion? And what really amazed me, I mean, they have bought everything except the kitchen sink. And I remember when it was always said the Federal Reserve is not allowed to buy anything except AAA-rated debt. Whatever happened to that?
Yep, universal market backstop. So a couple questions for you. We had in 2008 an unwind of debt. We had in 2008 a reflation effort. There wasn't enough reflation to keep there from being an unwind in the equities market and the bond market and virtually every market. We saw correlations go to one in virtually all markets. It'll be interesting to see, and we're interested in your opinion, what about this time? They had some disclosure and transparency, which was allowed in the initial stages, sort of 2007 coming into 2008. And then, of course, the FASB rescinded certain disclosure and categorization requirements. And rather than a crisis and collapse in the debt markets today, couldn't we see the same sorts of games played as in Europe? You know, you combine austerity with non-disclosure, hide things off balance sheet, you know, as Goldman Sachs did with great wizardry for Greece, but where we somehow keep the inevitable from happening and an unwind in debts just through sort of chicanery and deceit in the marketplace.
Yes, exactly. And it's happening right now with Greece. Greece is basically a default. But they can't let it officially be a default because the big European banks and primarily the big German banks are on the hook. They are loaded up to the gills with this kind of debt. In fact, it's estimated that the European banks hold about $1 trillion worth of the sovereign debt, which is, who knows what it's worth, maybe 50 cents on the dollar. If they would have to write that off, they would all be in violation of the capital requirement. And these banks would never be able to raise that kind of money. If you take $1 trillion worth of the debt, you take a 50% haircut of that, that's $500 billion. There's no way that these banks can raise $500 billion in the capital markets today. And this is the problem. So when Germany and France and these countries give more aid to Greece, that's not because they want to be nice to Greece. No, they want to save their own banking system. That's how bad it is. And the U.S. banking system is still so loaded up with unrecognized losses on their holdings of mortgage-connected debt. It is incredible. Just Bank of America alone has said that it's over $200 billion. Well, if that is what they say, you can maybe increase that by 50 or 100% of what the real number is. So this is why our financial sector, or the banking stocks, are acting so very poorly, because this kind of stuff is starting to surface. And the smart, knowledgeable investment pools are getting out of the banking stocks at the same time that they're telling the public, oh, these are great bargains. Look how cheap they are. Yes, well, they're cheap for a reason.
Bert, when you watch Angela Merkel basically commit political suicide coming into a second bailout and approving a second bailout for Greece, with the ramifications of the first bailout having still to be fully felt, she's watched her party lose state election after state election after state election, and yet she still votes for it. You're right. How bad is it? That question gets to be answered in Merkel's actions to say, basically, I don't have a political future, but maybe I can save the banking system. That's what I'm reading, perhaps between the lines, but isn't that what's being communicated?
Yeah, exactly. But there's one big problem, David, that very few people are talking about. And I think this is where the next tsunami in the financial world will come from, and that is China. China, in my opinion, right now has, on an inflation-adjusted basis, almost no growth. And I know that seems like an outlandish statement, but they're advertising about 9% of GDP growth. If you consider that their actual rate of inflation is not the 5.4% that they advertise, but
closer
that it's probably closer to 10 or 15%,
yeah,
that
for sure.
Basically adjusted the real GDP is barely above zero right now.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here.
Yeah. And we have the same distortion in the U.S. If you adjust our GDP, our nominal GDP, for the actual rate of inflation, not the 2.7% inflation that they said we had last year, then actually our economy right now, this very moment as we speak, is already contracting. We are in a recession right now. And the economists don't tell us that. They don't tell you that on financial TV. We are already in a recession. Whether it's the same recession that we had before, whether we ever came out of it, that's a different debate. But right now, our economy is contracting.
Yeah, you're exactly right. The economists of our day are forgetting that to be speaking of a return to a double dip ignores the fact that we're on life support as it is,
yeah,
with government deficit spending on the one hand, and as you just pointed out, GDP being measured with an inaccurate deflator, an inaccurate inflation gauge,
yeah,
to where it's utterly overstated. We're in negative territory. Let's look at something you love. You eat, sleep, drink, live technical analysis. In terms of the big picture and the primary trends, we look at the equity markets. Just in brief, let's look at the equity markets, emerging markets versus developed markets, bonds, precious metals, and maybe start with the equity markets. They appear to be putting in a top. But does this correspond to a short-term correction, or does it relate to a major downtrend in equities?
Well, you know, it's just like in the economy. In the economy, until about a month ago, 99% of all economists said, oh, it's strong, there's no chance of renewed recession, and so on. Now they're starting to change their tune, very much like in 2007, 2008. Now they're starting to talk about a soft patch. Oh, wonderful. Isn't it nice? Just a little soft patch, okay? And they have already reduced, economists from Wall Street, their GDP growth estimates for this year by 50%. Suddenly, they came out and they reduced their estimates by 50%. That's a heck of a big adjustment, 50%. Now, what they haven't done yet is reduce their profit forecast for corporations by an equivalent amount. Doesn't that stand to reason that if the economy is growing half as fast, that maybe profits are going to come down from their euphoric forecast level? So that's the next adjustment process. When finally Wall Street is nicely short, all the stocks that the people like, and then Wall Street starts with their downgrades, okay? Then the average investor loses a lot of money because he's still long. Wall Street makes a lot of money because they're nicely short. That's how the game is played. The game is not there for the average investor. But if you can figure out what the game is, you can make money alongside with them. All you have to do is turn off your TV.
That's a good call.
But in regard to whether this is short-term or long-term, I see major tops right now in all of the what I call overcrowded trades. The overcrowded trades is what everyone loved over the last 6 months or 12 months, which is commodities. It's oil. It's the stock market. It's being short the dollar. I think the dollar is going to have a very nice rise over the next 6 months and who knows, maybe even longer. So this is what our technicals tell us. We've broken major trend lines. In the stock market, all you have to do is look at the NASDAQ composite. The NASDAQ composite is still down substantially, you know, at about 2,700. It's still down substantially from the 5,000 high in the year 2000. But it got back to exactly the 2007 bull market peak. And there's a rule in technical analysis, as you know, that the further back the prior top is, the heavier the resistance is, because there's a lot of pent-up selling at that level. We are there now. So in my opinion, there's no way that the NASDAQ is going to go through that, make a higher high, but chances are very high. It's going to have a substantial down move from here. So a lot of technical rules that come into play, and because most hedge funds don't use technical analysis, because they don't understand it, you know, it's not a crowded trade to be short. And I love trades that are not crowded, where you're the only one, where people start laughing at you for even having the trade. Those are the trades that usually make you a lot of money. And you got to be so careful. I think your customers are really very lucky to have you, because you really know this stuff. You know technical analysis and so on.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
You know, Bert, the Saudi oil minister has certainly confirmed that he thinks oil belongs closer to 80 and 100 is overdone. And there's very right. There is a lot of vulnerability in a number of commodities. A rise in the dollar would take a lot of people by surprise. And again, I think that's what Mr. Market likes to do with great frequency.
Yeah, and we've been saying that for a long time now, that the oil price has been manipulated. And now there have actually charges been filed against the controlling shareholder, an individual from Europe, of a major tanker company, Frontline. And they and some other traders, they have allegedly, let's put that word in there, manipulating the price of between futures and spot. And the charges, I think it's filed by the SEC, outline exactly how it was done. It's very, very interesting. And they've got all this oil stored in these tankers, and the tankers are at anchor, loaded up with oil. There is no oil shortage.
Well, this is an interesting thing, and maybe we can get to it if we have time today. But you mentioned, you know, this manipulation in the commodities price. And just this week, we've got a UN report which is, you know, says this specifically: prices can move far from levels justified by the fundamentals for extended periods, leading to an increased risk of price bubbles. Due to these distortions, commodity prices do not always provide correct signals about the relative scarcity of commodities. And what the UN is suggesting is that the government intervene and basically control the prices of critical commodities. Is there a historical precedent in which price controls within the commodity space, or price controls on any asset class by a governmental authority, actually worked?
You know, well, I think, David, you know the answer. No, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the history, but I have never heard of one, read about one, or seen one example where price controls by government has worked. But what you can do is reduce the speculative influence. And, you know, I used to trade futures markets quite heavily in my younger days, and we had position limits. You couldn't hold more than X number of contracts for a specific commodity. And this prevented large trading operations from controlling the price of a commodity. Now, that's one way to handle it. How do you handle over-speculation in the stock market? It's not by preventing people from selling short. No, you do it by raising the margin requirement. That's what Greenspan should have done in 2006 and 2007. Instead of 50% margin, you should have said 80% margin or 100% margin, which is what the Federal Reserve used to do like 30 years ago. When I first started trading, they would move those margin requirements up and down depending on the amount of speculation in the market. And it really worked. It cooled things down. the speculators had to put up 80 or 100% of the value of a stock, it reduced the speculation and also made the system much stronger. What we saw in 2007 and 2008 was really a margin liquidation crisis. That's what it was. That's the first part of the financial crisis. Then we had the typical rebound. This was bear market rally over the last 2 years. And now we're going into the really painful part, okay? The margin call crisis didn't affect the average person as much, although they lost 40 to 50% of their portfolio. The next part is the slow grinding down process where just nothing goes up. Everything just continues to grind down. People don't have any reserves anymore, don't have any savings anymore, and so on. And people are losing their jobs, they're losing their houses, and you get more and more government in their lives. You get more efforts of government to control small businesses, which means small businesses don't hire. I mean, right now, I run into so many small business people. They said, hire anybody. I've got my business doing okay. I could use a couple of people, but no way. Under current regulations, who needs the paperwork headaches? So this is what happens when government gets too intrusive. People say, I don't need the headaches, so I'm not going to hire. When you don't have job creation, you have an economy that contracts.
Now, on the second issue, the emerging markets versus developed markets, it's become very popular to argue for sort of the replacement of the Western European and American consumer, and in their place, sort of the indigenous peoples of India, of China, of Brazil, of Russia, wherein they're becoming this new class of consumers with savings and resources and the largesse of the years where we were running deficits and they were running trade surpluses. Now they get to turn that internal. Can we regard the emerging markets as the growth play they're described as, or should we view them as really higher beta investments that, you know, have better returns on the way up, and actually are far worse on the downside?
Yeah.
Like in 2008, 30% here in the U.S. was 60 to 90% anywhere else in the world.
Exactly. And, you know, that's when you know it's a top, when everyone is in the emerging market. It's happened every time over the last 20 years. I can remember so many cases when people were starting to be careful about the U.S. market, and they said, no, but the emerging markets are so good. Look at all of these people, and they have so much to make up for, and they're starting to buy motorcycles, and they're starting to buy cars, and you've got all these beautiful stories. And then suddenly, you know, like in Thailand, when it was in the late 1990s, suddenly the market is down 90%, 90%, in spite of all these beautiful bullish stories. We have to recognize that the speculation in the emerging market has been much greater, especially over the last 2 years, than in the U.S. market. These markets have gotten so expensive, and there's so much fraud, financial fraud. You take a look at the Chinese stock market. You take a look at the Russian stock market. You take a look at India, etc. And all of that stuff is going to hit the fan. You know, I think Warren Buffett said one time, when the tide goes out, you can see who's been swimming naked. And we're going to see a lot of companies that have been swimming naked over the past 2 years. And it's going to hit the fan. And those markets are going to go down twice as much as the U.S.
Well, when it comes to bonds, I assume that if you're looking for a dollar rally and in a move out of equities or a major turn in the equities market, we may see pretty decent rotation into bonds. The 30-year, if you look at the yield, its low in 2008, 2009 was about 2.65. We've seen higher lows sequentially since then, 2.65 being the low, 3.5% since then, and we're currently above 4%. Can we get to 3.75? Can we get back to the old lows of 2.65? It seems that to some degree investors have to voluntarily accept negative real rates to be moving into treasuries. And is that something that, you know, we talked about, it's almost sort of the fraudulent Bureau of Labor Statistics and BEA numbers coming out with both GDP and inflation. If an investor class starts factoring in inflation, how do you accept a 3.5% yield knowing that you're losing 7% in terms of a real rate?
Yeah, David, once again, that's a very important topic. What has been the crowded trade on the bond side? It's being short or out of U.S. Treasury bonds over the past, at least the past 3 months, 4 months, etc. It's got to be a very crowded trade, overbelieved. And we gave up ISIG on bonds a couple of months ago and said, bonds are going to be the safe haven of investment again. U.S. bonds, U.S. T-bonds. It's going to be the safe haven. I believe that yields on the U.S. Treasuries will go back down to the lows that we saw in late 2008. And in fact, if you take a look at the shorter term, like the six-month T-bill, right now has a yield of just slightly above zero. Now, can you imagine that hundreds of billions of dollars are going into the six-month T-bill at virtually no yield? You have to ask yourself, why? Why is all this money? It can't be stupid money. It can't be money from people who don't know what they're doing. This has to be very informed money. So why are they willing to park their money in T-bills earning them almost no interest? There's only one answer to that, in my opinion, and that is safety. There's no other place you can put your money for safety. You know, you can't put that much money into a safe deposit box. And that's where it's at right now. So this shows you that there's something very serious ahead. You take a look at the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is going to have a good up move this year. Why would it? When everybody's talking about U.S. eventually defaulting on its debt, which will never happen. But everybody talks about it. Moody's, the rating agency, has talked about potentially downgrading U.S. debt. But the dollar is going up, okay? So when you see this, these kind of moves, there's only one answer, and that is safe haven. It's a safe haven for big money. And that is really a warning signal. This is just like 2008. I remember in January of 2008, when people were still denying that there would be a recession, although we were already in a recession at that time, I said in the Wellington letter, we are going to see the yield on short-term T-bills go below zero, which means that if you buy a T-bill, you actually have to pay money. And people thought that was crazy. Well, it happened. In October of 2008, it happened. T-bill yields went below zero. And why was it? Because it was a safe haven. And it's going to happen again.
The one quandary I have with the bond thesis is that looking at our balance sheet and looking at the Greek balance sheet, they're virtually identical. We're a bankrupt institution as a country, as is the Greek system. The difference is we have world reserve currency status, so we have quite a bit of privilege to abuse. And as you say, default is not necessarily going to be a part of our vocabulary as long as we can print and pay back with cheaper dollars. The quandary is, how do investors on a voluntary basis, even with the priority of liquidity, look at a balance sheet which since 2008 has gotten even worse than it was then, and look at that as a safe haven? Is it just a relative comparison?
It's relative to everyone else out there.
So an absolute loser becomes the relative winner.
Yes.
And that tells you just how frail the whole world system is.
That's
when your
correct.
Absolute winner is not even something that we're calling into question. That you can't look for that because it doesn't exist anymore.
That's exactly right. Europe is in much more dire shape. And I think Asia will be as well. So the U.S., once again, interestingly, will become a safe haven in spite of all of the problems that we have over here.
Well, something that you have looked at on a number of occasions, I think you've been more positive on the precious metals than I have as to the duration of the present bull market. And I guess while I've assumed that sort of 2015 to 2017 would mark the final blow-off in prices, suggested in times past that it could be a 25 to 30-year bull market, which would imply a continued bull run, not finally exhausting itself until, say, 2025 or 2030, which actually is an interesting overlap with one of our past guests, Neil Howe, who wrote the book The Fourth Turning, and his idea of there being sort of a final political and cultural capitulation inside the same decade, sometime between 2020 and 2025. Yeah, just put that in perspective for us. While you do, is there something in the mix that will surprise those interested in gold and silver? How do we get to 2025 or 2030 in terms of an enduring bull market?
It's going to be a very, very volatile ride. If you take a look, and I advise everyone to read a book on the German hyperinflation many years ago in the early 1900s. And how inflation just bounced around between deflation and hyperinflation and back down again and back up again. it was so volatile, you couldn't just take a position and hold it unless you paid absolutely no attention to the markets, just put your money in gold and said, okay, I'm not even going to look at it. And then, you, of course, you would have really made out. But if you were trying to trade those moves, you would have ended up bankrupt. They're just too volatile. We're going to go through various stages here. The next phase here is going to be stronger dollar, rush to safety, and fears of another financial crisis, especially something starting in China and then enveloping the whole world. That means that the precious metals are going to be in trouble during that time period. We saw that in 2008 when these big overleveraged trading institutions, especially hedge funds and so on, have to sell. They will sell anything that's liquid to meet margin calls. Some of these hedge funds, they're still working with 10 to 1 leverage, which is insane in this type of an environment. So they will sell gold, not because they don't think gold has intrinsic value. No, they sell it just to get cash so that they can meet their margin calls. So that's the next phase, in my opinion. That's going to be very tough for the long-term holders of gold. But if you have physical and you don't look at the markets, you can say, okay, fine, I'm willing to ride it out, even if it goes down 50%. Okay, that's a decision you have to make for yourself right now. And after that, you have to look at what will the response be. The response of the central banks of the world will be just to step on that accelerator as hard as they can, print as much money as they can. Trillions and trillions of dollars of computer money are going to be fabricated in order to stop the deflation, in order to stop the crashes. And that then will give you the next bull market. And we saw this coming out of 2008. We saw this big bull market in gold and silver continuing. You know, in 1981, we had done a study on the long-term cycles in gold. And we concluded at that point, when gold broke down through $694 to the downside, we said, that's it. It's going to be in a long-term bear market, and gold will go down for the next 20 years, according to the cycles. Lo and behold, it was exactly 20 years. The bottom was in 2001. Most of the time, cycles are not that accurate. This one was. But it also said in 1981, that would be followed by a 30-year bull market in gold. And we had no explanation what would cause a 30-year bull market in gold. Now we know. If the central banks respond the way I said to the next financial crisis by fabricating trillions and trillions of new artificial money, then you have the case for all of the money in the world. Everyone will look around and say, we've got to buy gold. In China, the government is encouraging Chinese people to buy gold. They know how important it's going to be over the long term for China to be a big holder of gold, whether it's the Chinese government or the Chinese people. So it's going to be very volatile, right?
We've combined kind of the short-term and long-term into our conversation, the big picture moves and some of the vicissitudes in between getting from point A to point B. There's some things that do happen, and we can expect them to. Your book, Financial Apocalypse, when I look at the word apocalypse, it's a word that's used either by extreme people or in extreme circumstances. And we know you're not the former, but in what ways do we have the latter, a set of circumstances at hand that warrants being described as apocalyptic? Is there no way forward, or simply no way forward under the current political, economic, monetary leadership? I mean, it seems, as I've read the book, I think our listeners should look at it. It's a great review of everything that's brought us to this point over the last 2 to 3 years. And like the captain of the Titanic, who was ignoring the small chunks of ice on the surface, maybe a different pilot would steer a different course. As it is, it doesn't look like that's going to be in our political future for some time, or at least a few years. Tell us a little bit about the book, the thesis, and why you think it is just that bad.
Well, the problem that I foresaw in 2007 was the huge excessive leverage existing in the system. And by some estimates at that time, it was about $1.2 quadrillion in derivatives outstanding. Quadrillion. That's bigger than a trillion. So, I mean, it's such a fantastic amount of leverage in the system. Granted, many of these derivatives are offset and so on. But when things start tumbling, you can't find the counterparty, or the counterparty to your derivative has gone bankrupt, then it becomes very serious. So the leverage, interestingly, if you take a look at the charts of credit, during every financial crisis we've had over the last 30, 40 years or so on, you've had a downward move the following year or two in the amount of leverage in the system, and the amount of debt in the system. Amazingly, after the 2008 crash, we didn't have it. Just leverage and credit just continues to pile up and continues to pile up in the system. We're doing right now the same things in Wall Street that they were doing in 2007. You know, once again, they're issuing junk bonds with the payment in kind. You know, instead of you getting interest, they have the option, when they don't have the money to pay you the interest, to pay you in kind, meaning with in more junk bonds, which are worthless, okay? So they have no covenant bonds again, no debt covenants at all in these bonds. So they're just pieces of confetti. And there are people lining up to buy this stuff. So nothing was learned in the last crisis. And there's something else, David. You know, every big financial crisis that I have looked at over the last 80 years or so, worldwide, you've had a major stock index going down at least 80%. This time, we didn't have it in the U.S. We had the S&P was down about 50%. So everyone says and everyone agrees that this was the worst that we saw since 1929. So to me, that suggests that the other shoe is about to drop, that we are still going to have another leg down. It will take longer. It won't be a sudden shock like 2008. But eventually, we'll probably end up where one of the major indices will be down 80% from the here becomes important, the 2007 peak or the year 2000 peak. And I think it will probably be the NASDAQ from the year 2000 peak. So that shows you that there's quite a bit of danger ahead. You know, in 2007, but people won't believe this stuff. In 2007, I wrote, I said, real estate prices are going to go back down to their 2001 levels. People thought that was crazy. Well, we're there. We are there in some parts of the country, and the other parts of the country are following. So never think that anything is impossible in this kind of environment. Over the years, I've always been the optimist at investment conferences and so on. I remember the late 1970s, many of my colleagues, you know, they were very negative. They were advising to buy survival food and all of this stuff. I said, it's not going to happen. You're not going to have hyperinflation right now, et cetera, et cetera. And as it turned out, that was correct. This time around, I'm probably the great pessimist.
Expect the unexpected. Now, there's some truth to that. I think we want to see and we want to create a world that's easy to live in. Wall Street certainly helps cater to that with providing ample good news. If it's not a severe correction like the free fall of 2008, maybe the second installment is more like the 1966 to 82 bear market, where we just ground sideways. And if you factored in the cost of inflation, you were so upside down, it'd make your head spin. The 66 to 88 was a terrible time to be invested in equities, but in nominal terms, you didn't lose much. In absolute terms, you absolutely got slaughtered. So that's where we would encourage our clients and our listeners to continue to think outside the box and price things in relative terms, where the equity markets are already down 80%, in gold terms, certainly, and could see the same kinds of lows that we saw even in 1932, an 89% haircut when all was said and done, leaving 11 cents of previous purchasing power on the table. Not a whole lot. Well, Bert, we look forward to seeing you in Las Vegas here in just a few weeks. I'm hoping that you've set aside either the evening of the 13th or the 14th, and we can again enjoy a meal together and have another conversation.
Well, that would be fantastic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to Freedom Fest and seeing you again, and that's always a great conference. I think this year they're looking for about 2,000 people, all paid, so it's a good quality audience of people who very much think alike, which means, you know, basically we need smaller government, not bigger government.
I think you'll find many more of the answers in the free market system than in sort of the statist response to the crisis that we're in currently. It's a great place to compare notes with like-minded people, I agree, and both Bert and I would look forward to seeing you there if you can clear your calendars for July 14th through the 16th in Las Vegas. Well, thank you, Bert, for joining us on the program.
Thank you, David.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Bert Doman. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.